I'm Phil Scraton, and I work in the School of Law here at Queen's, and for my sins. And a lot of you will know of me through my work on Hillsborough, which I'm not going to be talking about today. But it's pretty clear from my accent where I'm from, for those of you who don't know me. And this was going to be a very short, 5 minutes at maximum introduction, but because of the re-timetabling, rescheduling, the suggestion was that I take a bit more time. And so I was going to just wing it, and then I thought I can't do that. So this morning I cobbled together very quickly some of these slides. I say cobbled, but they're there with a reason and a purpose. They're not really cobbled. It's a great privilege to actually work with Mike and Mike Morris, who we've worked together on the Merseyside Writers on the Wall Festival for many years. He's actually taking time out from the festival. In fact, he was there at it last night. He's co-director of the festival, and it runs for a month. And it's probably one of the best, most radical festivals that are now run in the islands. So it's really good of him to come across, but I'll give him more of an introduction as we get closer to me finishing. So what I wanted to do was to... I know Mike's work. I've read Mike's work on George Garrett, and it's a great story. It's a metaphor, but it's also a great story for those of us from the city. I'll talk a little bit more about that when I get to it. But I wanted to try and put it into a broader context of the politics and ideology of Liverpool, Merseyside. I wanted to just raise some of the issues. Normally, if I was talking about Liverpool, I would be spending about an hour at least on any one element of the work. But I've just put together a few slides. I haven't even put up a front slide because I've just done it, literally. And I wanted to talk to start off by just mentioning the issue of legacy. Legacy here has a different meaning. I mean, I've lived here now 13 years, and I understand the different construct of legacy as it's used in the north. But legacy is really important, I think, when we start to think about how these populist comments that are made about the places in which we live, and this was made by the well-known analyst of horse racing, John McCurrick, on a late-night show in the immediate aftermath of Hillsborough. So you've got a picture of the fact that 400 people are seriously injured. At that time, 95 people had died. And it was the ease with which he was able to condemn not Liverpool football fans, which became the dominant narrative eventually, but the city. There's an underlying hardline menace in Liverpool, an aggression, a lack of will to work, a belief that the world owes them a living. That's what's happening in Liverpool, and the rest of the nation are sick of it. They think Liverpool is a cancer on the whole of the country and should be cut off, until they learn to work and respect everybody else. Now, you could say this is just an ideological construction from a guy who's ignorance of the city, ignorance of its history, ignorance of its place in the world. But it became a dominant narrative, particularly after the killing, and I worked on this case when I was in Liverpool, the killing of James Bulger, which was an exceptional act in any society at any given moment in time. These occasional tragedies happen. I'm not going to talk about that. But here we go with Auberon Waugh, who's not exactly John McCrerick. And he says, it's said that Liverpool's problems are all due to unemployment. I wonder what Liverpool's unemployment is due to. I fear it may be due to the stupidity, as well as the unpleasant habits of the people who live there. All the clever people left it long ago. Now, this narrative is not something that is isolated. In two of my books, I demonstrate absolutely clearly how this becomes a political and ideological construction that actually has dynamic economic effects on investment in the city and also on self-confidence within the city. It gets worse. The other kind of argument that's put forward, unfortunately using the phrase, given Liverpool, Liverpool-born black community, the dark side. Here we have in a book written on disasters by David Cohen, a well-known, actually, academic, Liverpool's darker side. a massive drugs problem, endemic unemployment, a resultant capacity for mass disorder, a ferocious reputation bearing the hallmarks of Neanderthal man. For the next week, I walked around in a crouched position with my hands touching my ankles to see what it felt like, and it was uncomfortable. But it was more uncomfortable in the head than it was in the body. Jonathan Margolis, again, writing in one of the broadsheet discussions post-Bulger, Liverpool's dark and ugly side, which has belied the cheeky scouse image it loves to promote. The most liberal of people can turn out to hate or at least be irritated by Liverpudlians. However much you like the city, Liverpool culture seems nevertheless to combine defeatism and hollow-cheeked depression with a cloying mawkishness. So what's this got to do with what we're going to be talking about? Well, it's got a lot to do with it. If we look in terms of the work that informs a lot of my own research, the connection between how cities and towns and communities are portrayed as socially disorganised and how that is linked to a pathological cultural or pathological social construction is absolutely crucial. So I'm not using this in the traditional criminological sense. I'm actually using it in a critical sense. What it does is we have to think about how those early 19th century social theories that link poverty, poor housing, overcrowding and disease to, yes, moral degeneracy. It's that relationship that is there in so much of the policies of the late 19th century that inform the cities and towns we live in. And that whole notion, that Darwinist notion of natural evolution and the struggle for space in our cities, the central ecological process that governs, as he would have put it, change in urban neighbourhoods. Alongside this, we see the diminishing over time of theoretical positions that are based purely on biological determinants, which would be the mid-19th century, being replaced by economic but socio-cultural determinants, like the kind of expressions that I've just given. What we have then is this organic, harmonious society, and we've seen this narrative in the last few weeks, that is threatened by social disorganisation and by inherent pathology within communities. So those populist discourses I started with actually are rooted in the way in which the towns, cities of the north in particular, but specifically Liverpool, as we'll see, are connected. What that is also connected to is the idea that you can catch moral degeneracy in the same way as you can catch a disease. In other words, it's infectious. It's transmitted among pathological groups. And in this, crime, deviance, conflict are reinterpreted as disease. It's what Suttle says in his work on Chicago and on Detroit, is that we carry these cognitive maps in our heads, but they're also in the heads of planners, not only what their city is like, but what they think it ought to be like. This cognitive map of the city need not necessarily correspond closely with the actual physical structure. What he argues is, therefore, is this becomes internalised. It becomes internalised in the broader culture. It becomes internalised in politics. But more potent than that, it becomes internalised within the community itself. A defeated neighbourhood, a community so heavily stigmatised and outcast that its residents retreat from most forms of public participation out of shame, mutual fear, absence of faith in each other's concern. Now look at the date on that. It's 1972. This was the moment when I was just at university in Liverpool, when we were seeing the first uprisings in the city. And that whole questioning of what a defeated neighbourhood looked like and felt like, and standing against that oppression, became so much a part of that period of my own first work. And at the same year, writing about Glasgow, Sean Damer is talking about the imagery that goes with this. Cursed ground, forbidden forests, haunted houses, university-recognised symbols. But then he talks about secularisation and urbanisation. The public expression of magical thinking limits the experience of space to physical and emotional danger. In other words, the idiom of the industrial city restricts the perils of the soul to fantasies of physical violence, madness, contamination. Certain milieu gather reputations for moral inferiority, squalor, violence, social pathology. Consequently, they objectify the fantasy of dreadful enclosure. And when I read this, I was an undergraduate, and it immediately had a resonance to me personally. It wasn't just an academic exercise for me. This was talking to me in the way in which my family talked to me about being working class people from Liverpool. And it connects to another one of my very favourite all-time writers, Frantz Fanon's work, where he's talking about how others, and we have to remember that this whole construct now of othering that people use so easily is not something that is new. It actually first appears in analysis in Simone de Beauvoir's Second Sex in 1949. Of course, I was introduced to Simone de Beauvoir when I was at university as being Sartre's wife, and that was it. And it was only afterwards that I managed to get my hands on Second Sex and realise what a brilliant, outstanding book it is. Frantz Fanon talks about, as if to show the totalitarian character of colonial exploitation, the settler paints the native as a sort of quintessence of evil. Native society is not simply described as a society lacking in values, but also the negation of values, the enemy of values, the absolute evil, corrosive, destroying, disfiguring. And of course that was applied applied by the British ruling class to Ireland, and particularly the phrase, as you all know, beyond the pale. That whole process then is about how identity, purity, nationhood are intertwined and how they become major constructions. So in that, the development and emergence of Liverpool, transforming from this sleepy village nestling on the banks of the Mersey, as Taffin Mulhern discuss, with a population of less than 1,000 in the late 17th century, becomes a bustling port with a population of 78,000 by 1801. And in the next 4 years, a threefold increase. In other words, it goes into triple figures within, not in a generation, but well within a generation. The mercantile economy of the area, based on unskilled occupations, exposing everyone to unemployment. And of course, the core issue of this period, from this period on, right up until 1964, particularly on the docks, and my whole male family were involved in this, was that their labour was casual. They were never contracted. They were always, all they knew was casual labour. The ship was in and you got it and you got selected and you knew the foreman, then you were away. The other issue that's important, and it's not my phrase, West Indian, I would use the phrase Afro-Caribbean, but what's really important is that migration to the city is not something that happens in the 1950s. That is not Merseyside. We're talking now about 9th and 10th generation African Caribbean communities, Liverpool-born black community in Liverpool. But it wasn't just about African Caribbean communities. It was about Irish, Welsh, Chinese, very big communities that come to be established during that period. And you can't separate out the distinction of, if we take a class analysis, then quite clearly what is happening is that those communities are coming in as a kind of underclass. They're created as an underclass. They're treated as an underclass. I mean, if you take, for example, when the Irish arrive, and this would be my mother's family, when the Irish arrive in Liverpool and Birkenhead, what we actually see is a major, and it's interesting that Bedford refers to them as refugees, he says, and he uses the phrase terrible potato famine. Of course, another way of looking at that is the Great Starvation. But when they actually arrive, in Liverpool, where do they go? Do they go into working class communities? No, they go into those houses that are condemned already in the Vauxhall area of Liverpool, where in the 1850s we saw outbreaks of typhus that took the lives of one in three people. You know, over 5,000 people dying in a very, very short period of time. And those were the condemned properties that the Irish were put in when they arrived in Liverpool. That is really the creation of an underclass, where the marginalisation is so obvious that you don't even have basic facilities and you're put into condemned housing. At the same time that that was happening, Liverpool was exporting 50% of the total UK production out of the city. Crazy when you think of it. It's halfway up the Irish Sea. It sets up as a port. You know, obviously the south coast would have been more significant. But just think about it for a minute. You've got sheep farming in Yorkshire. You've got coal in the north. You've got all of those issues that are coming out of the city. Cotton, the cotton trade in Manchester, hence the Manchester Ship Canal, which broke the back of Liverpool at the turn of the century. All of that is happening at this particular time, and therefore It's actually a capitalist market. The marginal, those who are on casual labour, they are pushed right to the bottom. It's out of this that we get the early portrayals of Liverpool as a violent city. This is Muir writing in 1907. The mob, joined by the unemployed and the discontented ruffians in town, roamed through the streets, proceeded to violence, sacking shops, bursting their way into public houses, tearing down the houses. And juxtapose that with what happens in 1981, at the moment that Oxteth, Liverpool 8, is part of the great uprising against the Merseyside police. The Liverpool-born black community, after generations of oppression, rise up almost as one, united, burn their own community, or parts of their own community. And this is the chief constable's response, and he could have been writing in 1907. He says, it's a matter of historical fact, that Liverpool has been beset by problems of violence and public disorder throughout the centuries. Her inhabitants have long been reputed to be proportionally tougher, more violent, and more pugnacious. I had a good mind to go around and smack him when he said that, but anyway. But the creation of that and how that goes into popular discourse is absolutely crucial. Martin Young, in 1978, had written this in The Listener, the BBC's the BBC's kind of flagship publication. The police are the first to define the problem of half-castes. Yeah, that's Liverpool-born black community in Liverpool. Many are the products of liaisons between black seamen and white prostitutes in Liverpool 8, the red light district. Naturally, they do not grow up with a kind of recognisable home life. Worse still, after they've done the rounds of homes and institutions, they gradually realise they are nothing. He would have used a stronger word, except he knew even in 1978 it wasn't right. It was bad enough when he says, the Negroes will not accept them as blacks, and the whites assume they are coloureds. The half-caste community on Merseyside, more particularly in Liverpool, is well outside recognised society. Sometimes you have to pinch yourself to believe that this happened, well, not in all of your lifetimes, but certainly in my lifetime. And that takes us back to the notion of dreadful enclosures. Here's McClure in 1980 writing a book on the police. I won't go right through it all, but at the middle there is all the glitters, merchants, moneylenders, beggars, meth drinkers, lying about legless. To his right, he's talking about the police officer on duty, the South Sub, the jungle noises, and even more the jungle behaviour of Clubland, then Yellow Country, Chinatown, then up in the right-hand corner, Black People Country, up at Parliament Street. And if he's coming on nights, the police officer, he'll probably see five sorts of stockades with campfires burning, places he can get in and out of the cold, safe from a hiding. You know, that was one of the best-selling books ever written, Spike Island, on the police. And it's not an academic book. The point I'm making, it's a book that is right at the core of popular discourse. And of course, then after we get through the whole process of the uprisings in Toxteth, we have its chief constable, Kenneth Oxford, giving evidence to the Scarman inquiry. And this is how he depicts the true Liverpudlian, as aggressive, belligerent, Liverpool populace, turbulent. The problems, he says, multiplied and aggravated by the large-scale immigration of Irish. Aggravated poverty, unemployment, overcrowding, as now, note the connection to 1980s immigration, the breeding grounds of violence. There's a chief constable giving a formal report to an inquiry. Appreciable numbers of Welsh rural labourers, foreign nationalities and foreign exiles, a remarkable increase in the number of coloured immigrants, initially seamen who stayed and married local white girls. The black community, like the Chinese, has been a feature of Liverpool life for generations. So we've got a bit of history right. Each of these communities brought with them associated problems. This is social pathology at its most obvious. Disputes and tensions, which on occasion spilled over into outbreaks of violence. And it's on this basis that we see institutionalised, and I never use the word institutional, all my work talks about institutionalised, it's when it gets right inside the depth of an institution. Racism, a long endured inhumanity, I wrote at the time in response to his work, or his evidence, in Liverpool's black and Irish communities. The picture painted by the city's well-known politicians is of a harmonious, integrated, cosmopolitan city. This ignores the brutal reality of the interwar period, when the first generation black community was continually the butt of white racism. It also veils the institutionalisation of that racism within the practice of local government and the state. And for me, that relationship between the marginalisation of class and the marginalisation marginalisation of neo-colonialism is the real connection. I can remember being brought up in my family. The men worked on the docks or went to sea. The women worked in service or shops. The men could never rely on bringing home money at the end of the week. It was all casual labour. And they used to talk to me about, because my mum's family, who were an Irish heritage family, they lived in Birkenhead within the Irish community around the Church of St. Werburgh's. And they talked to me about that period of time when they fought back, when they were actually fighting against. It's exactly the, and there's a point of all of this, it was exactly the point that George Garrett, the time that George Garrett was writing. And they talked a lot about, it was how I learned about the whole way in which their lives were in Birkenhead across the river from Liverpool. My dad was a Protestant from Liverpool. My mum was a Catholic from Birkenhead. They're talking here about welfare relief. For most, this meant having to succumb to the means test administered by the PAC, the body which was taken over from the Poor Law Guardians. The economy measures introduced under the national government the previous autumn heralded the arrival of the means test. Then they talk about the means test. And then the study that I'm quoting from concludes, in 5 out of every 6 cases, payments were reduced. Hunger and starvation began to close in. And we're talking here about 12,000 women and men then marching in Birkenhead on the PAC officers. And I remember being told this story. This is actually taken from the historical documents of the time for my book, The State of the Police, published many years ago. But I can remember my mother and father telling me this story. This was in their community. About 1:30 a.m., we were all fast asleep in bed, having had no sleep the previous 2 nights. We were all awakened by the sound of heavy motor vehicles, which turned out to be Black Marias. Lights in the houses were lit, windows opened to see what was going on. Policemen bawled out, "Lights out, and pull up those fucking windows." Hordes of police came rushing up the stairs, doors smashed in, screams of women and children from blows from baton. Our doors were bashed down by heavy instruments. My husband got out of bed without waiting to put on his trousers, and he unlocked the door. As he did, 12 police rushed into the room, knocking him to the floor, his head split open, kicking him as he lay. We were all in our nightclothes. The language of the police was terrible. I tried to prevent them hitting my husband. Then they commenced to batten me all over the arms and body. As they hit me and my gym, the children, 5 of them, were screaming out, and the police shouted, "Shut up, you parish-fed bastards." That is the legacy of the city and towns, that the city of Liverpool, the towns that surround it. That is the working class legacy that is connected directly into the whole issue of institutionalised racism in its development throughout the 20th century. George Garrett was writing at this time. George Garrett was a socialist who brought through his politics at this time. He too, like me, came from a family where one of his parents was Catholic, one was Protestant. When I first arrived here, people used to say to me, "How do you have such a handle on sectarianism?" I said, "I'm from Liverpool, and that should be enough for you to deduce the answer from." That issue of the way in which our lives, or certainly my father's life, my father was born 3 years separate from, 3 years apart from George Garrett. They maybe were even at sea together, I don't know. But that, when I first heard Mike talking about George Garrett, when I first heard the depth of the work that he was telling, he wasn't just telling this wonderful story of a great man, which it is. It's a phenomenal story. What he was telling was the story of our families. He was telling the story of our lives. And it's that dynamic, the dynamic between the political ideological constructions of our realities, which I started with, and the socially experiential sides of our lives, that is so significant about this work. So it seems like we're just talking about one person and his developmental process through politics and his influence in Liverpool. But we're not. We're talking about something much more deep than that, much more profound. And I think we should all be grateful to Mike for the fantastic work that he's done in establishing the archive in Liverpool, in rescuing this life, not as just a single great man, but it's representative of what all of us who are concerned about historical context, it's what we can draw out from those lives that is applicable and demonstrable for the lives of the class and the place and the spaces that they occupied. So I think I've probably filled my bit of extra time that we had, and without further ado, I want to introduce Mike and thank him very much in the middle of the Merseyside Writers on the Wall Festival, of which he's co-director, making the time to come over and speak with us. He's going to talk through George Garrett's life and contribution, and then there is a brilliant, very short 8-minute film to follow before we go on to questions.